Welcome to Monday here on Main Street. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein. Later today, we'll be joined by Dr. Isaac Kohani, a pioneer from Harvard University and the editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine's inaugural AI-focused publication. He'll discuss the evolving role of artificial intelligence in healthcare, detailing its long-standing use in medical assessments and its transformative potential in patient diagnostics and treatment planning. But first, we initially planned to discuss fluoride in our drinking water. Instead, our conversation with Troy Hall, director of the Fargo Water Utility, turned into an informative tour of the facility. We'll explore the origins of Fargo's water and discuss contingency plans for extreme drought conditions. Troy Hall is the Water Utility Director for the City of Fargo. Welcome to Main Street, Troy.
Yeah, thank you.
We're looking at some of the modern technology here that's involved in Fargo's water system, and that's where we're going to start today. What are you showing me?
Well, I was just going to show you, we have some new technology that's been implemented the past 5 years, but I just wanted to show you before we go into the plant. It's been three consecutive years that we've had best tasting water awards, two at the state level in 22 and 23, and then it was really cool, a surprise. We placed second place nationally against all the winners of the states in US and
so
Canada.
So Fargo has great tasting water.
That we try. So
I don't disagree with that.
Yep.
I'll
so
have
we,
you know.
We try. And then another thing we did, those were blind taste tests, but this membrane facility was a facility of the year. That's North America, Mexico, Central America. That's where membrane water plants could be nominated, but we were awarded this membrane facility of the year by American Water Works, which is a big organization.
So what is a membrane facility? What does that mean?
That's great question. So with the membranes, what we do is physically remove, say, particles or dissolved salts from the water. We either push the water through membranes or pull it through by vacuum, but it leaves the particles or whatever we're trying to leave behind, it leaves them behind, and it really does a great job of cleaning up the water, taking out any like pathogenic germs in the water too, to make it safe for people to drink. And it really works fantastic. It's been a great addition for Fargo.
Fargo gets its water from the Cheyenne and the Red River?
Correct. Yeah, so Cheyenne and Red River. And in the industry, we do know the Cheyenne and Red are they're really challenging to treat, but we have the tools to do it with our treatment facility, and we've adapted. We actually have an older plant that you're standing in right now that's came online in 1997, but that's a really fantastic plant too. But we want to run them both together to make tap water for our staff, our people.
Are you at capacity, or can you generate more water if you need to?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. From a capacity standpoint, by our infrastructure, we can probably support about 50,000 more people population. We have, at least in theory, we have 45 million gallons per day capacity with both water treatment plants running full out. But we hit at times in the summer with 31, 32 million gallons a day, which is a lot of water. But typically on an average day, year round, it's about 14 million gallons a day that our citizens use.
And you periodically help West Fargo with their water supply. How does that work?
Yeah, so that's been a great partnership with West Fargo. And then we also serve Cashmore Water, parts of other parts of Cass County as well. But with West Fargo, those numbers I gave you as far as capacity, that includes West Fargo. But with that, we have three connections with the city of West Fargo, and their water towers sit just a little bit higher than Fargo because they're a little further, like off the river, ground elevation's a little bit higher. So we have three pump stations just bump the pressure up just a little bit so we can fill their water towers, and then they just get the same water Fargo residents get.
And we'll talk about different challenges I think that you face day in and day out. But one thing I'm curious about, we are in the older part of Fargo.
Yep.
And part of what you do is you get water to the facility and then you treat it, it's ready to go, but then it goes out into the city's infrastructure.
Right.
How is the city's infrastructure? How big of a challenge is it in this A environment and B with its age to keep up?
Yeah, it's really, I would say it's very challenging with, you know, the we're trying to keep up. We're trying to improve our infrastructure. We do have a, I feel, a really good partnership with other city departments. So we work closely with engineering, with public works, and other parts of the finance, other parts of the city, to work together to improve the infrastructure. So, you know, one of the things that's happened for a long time is they started replacing cast iron water main pipe, which is corrodes and likely to break. And there was just a period of time the piping wasn't as great. So we've been replacing over time on an annual basis. We replace that cast iron water main with PVC pipe. And so it's really worked well. So there was a time, I think it was like 1997, maybe somewhere in there, there was like 693 breaks or something like that. It was a really big number. You can imagine city crews trying to fix that number of breaks in the system. Now we're less than, we're maybe 20 a year. And then so our crews, you know, it's efficient for our city crews, and they can work on other things with the maintenance of the system.
Relatively speaking, is Fargo's water inexpensive or expensive compared to others in the region?
Well, you know, if you compare, very good question. If you compare it to other like surface water systems, because like groundwater is a little different. When we walk through, it's very complicated to do this treatment, as you'll probably see. If you're groundwater, you can just kind of pump it out of the ground, and you might add a couple of things, and then you're good to go.
Artesian wells.
Yeah, like we were talking about a little while ago, but with that, when you compare against other, either nationally or regionally, we're kind of in about the lower third as far as water rates, and we have very challenging water treats. So we have several strategies to keep our rates in check, but we actually do. I'm kind of amazed how well we do as far as rate, but we do a series of things to try and keep our, you know, rates reasonable for our customers.
Being new to the area, it seems to me like there's water everywhere.
Yeah.
But Fargo could run out of water, theoretically, yeah. And it's been close recently.
Yeah. No, in 2021, and a lot of people know that, it was very dry. And our two sources of water, the Red and Cheyenne River, they really slowed down as far as the flow. So, you know, two things. We are working on a major drought supply project, and that's in combination with, you know, Grand Forks and other cities and the state. And that is to bring Missouri River water in times of drought this way, because that, like in what our comparator is like the 1930s Great Depression, when it was very dry, the Missouri kept flowing really strong at that point. And so
that's a $1 billion project.
It's over a $1 billion project. That's great. Again, a great partnership, you know, statewide and locally. But it's about, right now, it's about a 75%. We locally pay about 25% for it.
One of the arguments that came up from time to time where I used to live in Wyoming was this concept of in-stream flow.
Yeah.
That, hey, you can take water from here, but by golly, you're not taking it all.
Yep.
We need XYZ to continue flowing on down the mm-hmm. river. Are you up against those constraints?
I think it's such what we need, even though it seems like a lot of water for it's kind of minuscule compared to what's flowing down the Missouri. So it's really, it's not like it hasn't been discussed at all, but it's really hasn't been much of an issue. It's because it's such a small portion of what's flowing.
Before we start our tour here of the water treatment plant here in the city of Fargo, what's your biggest challenge? What worries you?
Everything. No, I don't know. It's we try really hard to provide the best service, but you know, we try to do the right things day in and day out. But you know, it is you know, between the water quality and keeping people's rates in check and making good decisions on infrastructure changes and all the other things that go along with it. You know, it's there's a lot of things that probably keep person up at night, but we you know, we're I think we do pretty well overall. For
Troy, what caused me to reach out to you initially was an article that I had read.
Yep.
That talked about how fluoride added to water potentially could impact mm-hmm. children's IQ and make it lower. It would be a problem for them.
Right.
Makes you ask the question, how do you know what to add to water? How do chlorine maybe, or fluoride, or other things, How do you know what to do, and how do we know it's safe?
Yeah, well, what we do, and with the fluoride question, what we do is we follow Center for Disease Control, EPA, other, you know, there's, I can give you a list of all the supporter, American Dental Association, they all support it. So, but we try to be, we are at an optimum level. We follow, just follow those guidelines. Some of the things that with the AP article, the concentrations they're talking about are much higher, or higher than the optimal level. So we just keep at the recommended optimal level, and we'll just follow, that guidance until, if the
guidance could change.
Different. Yeah, until there's a change,
And I should interject here. I've read, and we've talked about off mic, really, water is one of the most regulated industries there is. What do you have to do to show that Fargo's water is great?
Yeah, well, one of the things we do is we do put out a water quality report, as is every system in the U.S. They're required to put it out every year, and it just shows that we meet all the EPA requirements and stuff. Yeah, we're very heavily regulated, but we just try to do. We do the right thing. We follow those optimum levels and the best practices and make it work. So that's, water, we just do that day in and day out.
The other thing that I'm very interested in, and it just seems so awesome, is people who work for water systems and the Fargo water system, they're certified and they have to take tests to gain those certifications, and then more tests and more tests. Talk a little bit about that process.
With the testing, I know that, most, as far as our management and administrative folks, a lot of us are, like myself, are former operators. So we did those series of tests, in my case, it was a while back, but we have to go through those tests. And then we do hire technical people. They may not have the certifications, but we have, in our world, with the changing world, we have lots of electronics and instrumentation and things to help us monitor the process. So we have a real variety of technical folks here, but they do have training, and they have to go through a certification process.
We're enjoying our conversation with Troy Hall. He's the Water Utility Director for the City of Fargo. Real quickly, besides fluoride, what else is added to water here in Fargo?
Well, what we try to do, well, actually, interesting, the treatment process, they actually remove a lot of stuff. So so it's probably more of a removal thing. So we remove hardness, remove salt from the water, we remove turbidity. So if you look at the Red and Cheyenne River, sometimes it's not, sometimes it looks pretty clear to the naked eye, but it's, it's pretty dirty. But it sometimes it can look pretty dirty, such as when we're getting runoff and things like that. But it actually, the plants actually remove a lot of stuff too. What we do add is we add chlorine ammonia combination called chloramines. And what that is, it's a disinfectant that stays in the water throughout the distribution system, but that's a necessity. That's probably one of the most critical requirements that we have to follow EPA, is that we keep that water from a growth that of organisms that might cause disease in our water, because that was, that's one of the big health improvements over the past 100 years or so.
The industry, as we were again talking about off mic, got a black eye with what happened in Flint, Michigan.
Right.
What did you think about when you started learning more about that?
Well, that's it certainly...
It was a lead issue in water.
Yeah, the lead, it's really... the lead in water, it's not the water coming out of the treatment plant per se, it's corrosion in the distribution system in homes and homes that might have like lead service lines. So it's really sending the water out that's corrosive to piping. And it is, that was disappointing. We actually in Fargo, we are very strategic in how we send our water so it doesn't corrode the piping in homes and stuff, or try not to. Our lead, when we do the testing, and we're required to do a significant amount of testing there for lead, our concentrations are very, very low in Fargo. We have a track record since the regulation came into effect, probably 1992 or 93. So we've tracked over the years how we're doing with that. So initially we met the regulations. More lately with the newer water plant and stuff, we're super low on our concentrations.
When I turn my faucet on and the water comes out,
yep.
what would you like me to know that I probably don't? The biggest surprise to me would be what, when that water fills my cup?
Well, you know, interesting you ask that. One of the most common questions we get is winter time. And so what if you take like a clear glass, so the water gets cold, and with get it cold, it allows more dissolved gases to be in the water. And then so like air, it's just air like you breathe, right? But when it goes out to the home, it's winter time, it has those dissolved gases, it's under pressure in the piping, and you put it into a glass, it turns cloudy right away because all those bubbles come out of solution, and then it'll clear from the bottom up. It's just air. There's not a health issue with it. It just looks, oh, my water's cloudy in it, and it's really not. It's just air coming out of it, and it'll clear up within a minute or two.
You've offered Troy to take me on a tour.
Yes.
Let's do that.
Okay, sounds good. We got some of our operations staff. This is our control room here. These are the smart people that run the plant. They're going through kind of end of the day stuff. It's late in the day for our
stuff. Right now we're talking about
filters. Yeah, okay.
Is this a 24/7 control room?
It's a 24/7. So we're 24/7, 365. We've been doing a lot of, you know, awful lot of construction in the last 10 years, but we just keep the water flowing. We have to through the water plant, but this is the control room. So we do see, you know, a lot of stuff. One of the things I just wanted to point out is we have a lot of what we like 24-hour trends. So we watch this. These are some of the critical things. There's other critical things, but these are the critical, some of the critical things that we watch throughout our plant from a quality standpoint. And the only point is it's right in front of our face. We can see it, all the critical things. Something doesn't look right, we address it.
Yeah.
This is trends, I guess, on steroids, if you get, I mean, it's just a lot of stuff, but we wanted it right in front of our.
What we're looking at is four large screens.
Yep.
With probably 30 charts and graphs in front of you or so, maybe a few more, maybe a few less. And that's the other side of the room, are 27 cameras that you have on every part of your system.
Yep. So this is just a statistic on this that you look right here. And I'm just picking on this as a screen, but our old SCADA, which say existed 10 years ago, it was just one screen. You'd have to take some time to pull up each individual graph. So what we've done is we've put a whole bunch of information that's just, it's live, it's there all the time. So if you count the points, and I'm not gonna do that, but if you count the points here, it may be something like 25 to 30. Whereas, and then I think about mouse clicks, it took about four mouse clicks to get one trend up, you know, in the old days, but four mouse clicks gets you four screens like this. So it's literally 100 times, you know, like 100 times faster.
And I'm reading real-time information about the water coming in from the Red River and from the Cheyenne River, correct?
Exactly, yep. So we have Red River to membrane plant, Cheyenne River to membrane plant.
Is that millions of gallons per day?
That's millions of gallons. MGD is million gallons a day, yep. So that's, we're just right in the middle of, we're switching to our Cheyenne River. We had some construction activities at our Cheyenne this week, but typically what we do, it's more of a, it's a treatability and cost thing. So whichever river is favorable, that's what we run from. So we, again, goes back to water rates and being cost efficient. So just want to show you all the trends there.
Do severe storms and specifically a lot of rain really cause you headaches?
So with the storms, along with our, you saw all the control system information and trends. We also, our operators, they track storms too with the radar. And so like if it looks like there's a chance we're gonna lose power, a realistic chance that we could see a bump in power, they turn on a backup generator as a protective measure, and then we don't lose power because it's a big place, there's a lot going on, so to bring the plant back up, it sometimes can be a big deal.
So you try to be proactive and use alternative power even though you may or may not lose it during a storm.
Correct. So that's just a standard thing that we
How about with the water itself?
Yeah.
After you've gotten a whole bunch of inches and inches of rainwater.
Yeah, so the rain, what it really does is it lowers our demand, and I can show you. So this gets back to, you know, the control system, just different screens, but
you can look in real time what's stored in every water tower.
Yep. Yeah, what's stored in every water tower. And then we did a, so this is actually, we look over the last week here, So we see what the water demands. So the blue line is Fargo water demands. The green line is West Fargo water demand. So West Fargo is a little bit smaller, so they use less water. And then this is the total demand. And so what we would see when we get a rain is we'd see this demand drop off, and then we'd have to slow down the water plant. With rains, the other thing you maybe think about is, you know, we get a rain, we get runoff, we might get the river might get a little more muddy. That really comes out on the front end of our treatment process. So basically, you know, it just comes out right away. So then we don't worry about it beyond the front end of our process.
So you're really saying it doesn't matter really how dirty the water is.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, like with our water, that's, you know, it's kind of unusual for Fargo. Is we have red and shine. They're variable. The quality is, there's so much variation. Sometimes day to day, sometimes, you know, it's totally different this week than next. So we're just so accustomed to dealing with, and what our goal with our tools and our treatment process is just no matter what gets our way, it just goes out kind of the same to our customers. And that's our goal.
Troy, how long have you been doing this?
A long time. I've been doing this for over 30 years. I started as an operator, a part-time operator when I was going to college, and then full-time operator for a few years, and then just kind of worked our way through various positions into this position. But it actually about 12, a little over 12 years in Fargo. Really, I'm excited every day to come to work and to do what we do.
You have some bottled water on the right side and a cup with a faucet here in Fargo on the left side. What are you drinking from?
I'm gonna drink from the cup of Fargo on the left side.
Really though, why is that?
I don't know, because I do it every day and I know how hard we work at it, that I'm just very, I never take it for granted, but I'm very, you know, confident in what we do, that we, the amount of effort, the level of effort that goes in. So I have no issues drinking the tap water. Yeah, there are about 30,000 membrane fibers, and these are if you look at them, they're tiny, but they're called hollow fiber. And what happens, we pull vacuum on this module, and the debris and particles stay the outside, the clean water comes out.
It's just these little tiny guys.
Little tiny, so there's like 30, there's about 32 to 34,000 of these little fibers in this module.
My grandma's sewing needle would not fit into this hole. Yeah. It would be larger than the size of this hole that the water passes through.
Yeah, but can you imagine, like right now there's probably 17 million gallons of water a day coming through these little tiny fibers. Yeah.
So the idea there is that the water's small, the particulates are bigger.
Yep.
The water can fit through and the particulates can't.
Right, exactly. You're spot on. And you can see how easily they break.
Yeah.
So the other thing with our system, if there is a fiber break, and you see how easy they are to break, if there's a break, that means it can allow debris by, and we can't have that. So we watch them, and we have our control system watches them for breaks. And so when we do have break, we got to fix them. So we got to find out which of these 33,000 fibers is broken, and then we do. You see here's the holes, all those holes where that water comes out, it sucks out. So you put a little dab of, it's almost like a dental office. We put a little like dab of glue and UV cure it so it stops the leak.
Shut that one down,
in theory you shut one, but you probably shut, you know, 10, 20, you know, whatever. But when you have 32,000 fibers, so that's pretty neat. And
how many of these modules go into your filter system then?
Yeah, so there's 96 of these go into what we call a cassette. So there's 96 in a cassette, and then there's 24 cassettes. So
a lot. Each one of these is about 3 foot by 3 foot.
Yep,
or so.
And about 4 or 5 inches wide. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's pretty neat. And that's the big membranes. Then this is particulates, and then what we do have over here, which we won't be able to see inside, but we have a reverse osmosis, which I think a lot of people have heard of reverse osmosis, but these are the reverse osmosis cartridges that are in our reverse osmosis system. And what that does that'll actually leave behind dissolved salts. So that's how we take the salt out of the water to take hardness and stuff, at least on the membrane side. And it's little, these rolled around, or they're called spiral round RO, reverse osmosis elements, but they're just a series of sheets that you put water really high pressure through them, and it just leaves the salts behind and puts clean water through.
We extend a heartfelt thank you to Troy Hall, the director of the Fargo Water Utility, for granting Main Street unparalleled access during last week's enlightening tour. After the break, we'll delve into how artificial intelligence is revolutionizing healthcare in ways unimaginable just a few years ago. Don't go anywhere. Stay tuned to Main Street.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the John and Elaine Andrist Charitable Trust, supporting the communities of Northwest North Dakota. Information at nwndcommunityfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Main Street. On this Monday, we hope you had a wonderful North Dakota weekend. Our show continues with Dr. Isaac Cahoney, and he discusses the role of AI in healthcare. He's joined by co-hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner, who have spent four decades addressing challenges in accessing healthcare at community health centers. Their discussion with Dr. Cahoney will shed light on innovative approaches within the field, offering inspiration to those who believe healthcare is a right and not a privilege.
Well, Dr. Cahoney, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare. When we talk about artificial intelligence, AI, there's a lot of confusion. I'm wondering if you could just share with our listeners how you define AI in healthcare.
So I think that defining it is in some sense a fool's errand, because the goalposts keep moving. I think that back in the 1980s, automated interpretation of an ECG would have been considered artificial intelligence. Then in the 2018, being able to interpret the retinogram taken of a patient to decide how much diabetic retinopathy they would have would be seen as AI. Now it's being seen as the ability to look through a patient's record and come up with a differential diagnosis, a second opinion, a therapeutic plan. And I think, therefore, the best definition is one that essentially is a bit of a kicking the can down the road, but it's any computational process that allows clinicians to increase the accuracy and the reliability of their clinical performance, and or allows patients to augment their own decision making.
You know, you've just mentioned something that's kind of important, that AI has been around for a while. It's probably only in the public's mind since generative AI has come into place. But you walk through a historical view of AI and its implications.
That's right. And to be fair, I grounded that comment in my own history, where I did my PhD in artificial intelligence back in the 1980s. But truthfully, AI in medicine goes back into the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And yes, it is this remarkable thing, this remarkable event, where in the fall of 2022, the public was given access at the same time as doctors to a then state-of-the-art large language model that under the hood was only supposed to be able to predict the next word in a sentence, and technically that's what it did, yet functionally seemed to be able to have sophisticated conversations around everything from how to create a rap ode to the president to a genetic diagnosis of a patient.
Well, I think that you've simultaneously given reassurance to everybody in practice today that no matter how long they've been in practice, they in fact are somewhat expert at the use of AI, using the examples that you give, that patients maybe for the last, 10 years or so, at least fairly widespread, have gotten used to patient portals and some degree of automation. But it is indeed a brave new world, as you noted, starting just in the last year or two, you've got the new journal. You're the first editor of the New England Journal of Medicine AI. Tell us about some of the articles that you've published that you think really will stand out when we look back at this moment of time as having moved us forward in giant steps, not incrementally.
That's a great question. I should have anticipated that question and thought harder about it. I have recency bias. And so in the last month, we've published two articles, one by a group that's bi-coastal, going from UCSD to Children's Hospital in Boston, talking about the fact that in order to really evaluate AI in medicine programs, just having simulation labs that are being deployed nationwide are not actually sufficient. What we really need is clinical evaluations using clinical trials to evaluate these programs. And I think it's a very important point because what we know now is that just training a program as per a certain FDA threshold does not mean that program's going to behave the same way in different patient populations mm-hmm. with different practices of medicine. There's a lot of localization that has to happen. And there's another article that just came out now with David Blumenthal and a colleague of his, Patel, at Google. And it's about regulation. And they're taking a very provocative view, which I think may actually have some legs, which is that after they summarize the FDA process, they look at the generality of these generative AI programs, which unlike the programs that were state of the art merely 5 years ago, which had very narrow tasks, such as retinopathy gauging, such as checking if there's a bleed in an MRI of the head. Instead, these generative AI programs can have long conversations that cover a wide area. And so what Patel and Blumenthal are proposing is that we start using the same tools that we use to evaluate human intelligence in clinical performance on these programs, not just taking exams, but have them in the clinical workflow and evaluate how they do. Because as they note, there's a huge difference between how these programs work as a demonstration as opposed to the reality of healthcare. So that's my recency bias in looking at the policy impact. I think that other important articles have been showing how to use particular clinical cases from your own institution to increase the accuracy of these programs. And again, back at the macro level, it's not much of a science paper, but it's a interesting perspective. A study which looking at clinicaltrials.gov and a WH registry of all the clinical trials happening in the world showed that, yes, there's a lot of such trials happening in the United States and in the UK, but where are most of these trials happening? In China. Mm-hmm. And so we have, you know, and that poses many, many challenges for us. A, because of current political configurations, regulators in China and in the United States don't have particularly close calibration. And it's not very clear how trials run in China pertain and are transferable to US populations. But nonetheless, we have to recognize all the activities that's happening there and recognize that AI in medicine is a global activity. Mm-hmm. And how we embrace that is going to be essential. And part of what has happened as in my role in as editor-in-chief of NEJM AI is that I'm very aware of all the governmental efforts in multiple countries about how to regulate this. And it's an uncomfortable moment because the questions that you're asking are the questions the governments are asking themselves. What is this?
Right.
What does it mean? How do we safely regulate it? Yeah.
Well, I think that's a good beginning lit search for people to get a primer on most recent research.
I will say, because I know that we're we have finite time. I want to also focus on the fact that we have to compare the deployment of these AI systems to the current state of the art. And I can tell you that when I have faculty coming to my department for the first time that we just recruited, and they come to me and they say, Zach, where am I going to get my primary care? I've done this enough times to know that I cannot get them good primary care in Boston, at this central mecca of healthcare. If you look at Mass General Brigham, all the primary care clinics are not accepting new patients anymore.
Right. Hence the famous headline, nobody can see you now, in the Boston Globe not too long ago.
Well, you know, we are in the primary care space, and we understand that very clearly. It's a real public health crisis that Americans have to deal with. I do want to go talk a little bit about the regulatory.
Wait.
Go ahead.
So here's my point. In that context, consider the case of a child who was having difficulty walking, difficulty chewing, intractable headaches, was seen by 17 doctors over 3 years, multiple imaging studies, no diagnosis. The mother was told at the end of 3 years she should consider having this kid seen by a psychiatrist. The mom, non-doctor, takes all that text from all the reports, shoves it into GPT-4, and GPT-4 says, this could be tethered cord syndrome, where the bottom of the spinal cord is trapped in the bones. And so she goes to a neurosurgeon where she lives in Michigan and asks the neurosurgeon, could this be tethered cord? Neurosurgeon looks at the imaging studies, says, yep, that's what it is. They do the surgery, the child's cured. Now, what had happened is that originally the imaging had been misinterpreted, and then everybody never looked at the original image. GPT-4 didn't get to see the image either, but it could infer from all the findings what was going on. So my point is, in the era where patients do not have access to the conversations in primary care, where even if they do have access to primary care after N months, it's a very short visit and they have more questions, they're out of luck. We have to ask ourselves, what is the risk-benefit ratio of providing patients access to this with all its warts, given the fact that they do not have access to expert care? And the other alternative, Dr. Google search, has many, many more problems. And therefore, I think that the reality-based conversation is, what is this, the meaning of having unleashed this intelligent program with all its flaws in our healthcare system, where we're falling down on the job?
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting, and we subscribe to this view that our patients actually have a lot of AI that they will probably use, which is actual intelligence, where they will take that information and put it in the appropriate things and strive for the answers. I want to talk about the regulatory environment. You talked a little bit about China. America really has, it's sort of wild, wild west. They haven't really given any guidelines. The EU is much different, though. They've progressed further. What's your sense of this regulatory environment? Because it's going to have a big impact on researchers and on advancements.
Well, I think that it's a complicated question because of the fact that, on the one hand, you're right, there's not a whole lot of actual definition of what constitutes acceptable clinical performance in this country. But I held a conference in Maine, an international conference, just an invitation only, with around 60 experts from around the world back in October of 2023. And what was very interesting is after the conference, a lot of the Europeans came to me and they said, we're really thankful to come to your conference, that we came to your conference, because yes, there's a lot of advanced legislation coming forward in Europe, but it's all about the harms and the risks, and it's not about the potential benefits. And we have 400 million citizens who are probably getting inadequate care. And so I would hypothesize, based on this kind of feedback and others like it, that there is, on the one hand, a fearful and overly focused on risk approach that ignores the potential benefits. And on the other hand, a totally laissez-faire system where we're not asking on which data was it trained to ask for transparency. How is it being aligned or steered? And because it's early days, it's possible that we get locked down in one or more of those extreme modes. But I'm optimistic, actually, that there are leaders of goodwill in all these different countries. And so that after some possible early missteps, they are actually going to focus more on the middle, which is a balance of risk and benefit, given the current performance of our healthcare system. And so that is a conversation that has to include the not only patients, but all the medical societies. And I would argue that the medical societies have been way too bashful, too shy. They need to be engaged right away in this conversation. Yeah. I wrote a book back in the end of 2022 with my friend Carrie Goldberg and Peter Lee, the president at Microsoft, head of Microsoft Research. And we wrote the book about GPT-4 and in medicine and beyond, because we felt there was not a conversation happening. And there would be a bunch of advanced policymakers who would know about it, and some advanced technologists who would know about it. But this is fundamentally a how do we see ourselves as a society question.
Yeah.
It's a values question. And that's why your podcast is so important. We need to engage our healthcare professionals.
Yeah.
And I see a great counterexample of how not to do it in what happened to electronic health records. Mm-hmm. We decided that electronic health records were not our job. It was the job of the chief information officer and the C-suite in our hospitals. And because of that, we abdicated all responsibility in the usability of these products, mm-hmm. in what job they got done. And as a result, we contributed mightily to disaffection, moral injury, and burnout.
And part of why there's fewer primary care providers.
That's right.
To see people. But, you know, I want to just stay on that point for 1 minute. And I know we're getting close to the end, but there is a, you know, there's a pattern of it taking a long time to bring into the education of our next generation of healthcare professionals, providers, everybody, these kinds of mega changes that will really affect the course of care and the course of their careers. What are you hearing, seeing in terms of schools of medicine, nursing, dentistry, other schools really embracing, including the use of AI in their medical education programs?
So I think that at the top, at leadership of medical schools, there's real interest in including AI as an interesting part of education. But that turns out to be very hard to do, because shifting medical education is one of the really hard lifts.
Right.
So I can tell you the dean of the medical school at Harvard, for example, George, is very determined that this should happen. And yet a lot of our faculty are not yet using it in that fashion, and therefore I think would have some difficulty teaching it. We'll make progress, but what's clear is our students today are already using it.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so it's an odd situation where the medicine of the future is clear to our young students and our establishment is not very clear how to educate it.
Let's talk a little bit, just a one last question about the future. AI isn't sentient yet. 5 years out, where will we see this future of AI in your mind?
So I think it's going to be, because we're seeing a broader workforce problem in pediatrics, in primary care, in geriatrics, it is, I think, 5 to 10 years from now, you'll see an increasing fraction of non-MD professionals, such as nurse practitioners, physician assistants, augmented by AI to perform at a very high level. You'll see a lot of the interpretive studies, such as echocardiograms, being interpreted not by cardiologists, but directly from the echocardiographer, who's not an MD, going through an AI to give a very detailed cardiac readout to the primary care professional who might not be an MD. And so I believe you'll see in the 5 to 10 year throw, a lot of non-classical MDs, clinicians, using AI routinely as an augmentation. And I also predict this is the United States, after all, kick in the pants from a few legal cases where someone missed something because they did not use AI.
Well, nurse practitioners and physician associates are already 50% of the workforce in primary care and community health centers, and more than that in many communities. So it's great to have an additional tool. But the good news is when we say who will see you, they're answering the question much of the time. But Dr. Kahaney, thank you for your thoughts, for your work, for your insights. And thanks to our audience for being here. Be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube. Find us on Facebook and X with our account name CHC Radio. And as always, go online to chcradio.com to sign up for our email updates. And please share your thoughts and your comments about this program and all our programs. Dr. Kahaney, thank you so much. The journal is terrific, and we look forward to continuing to learn from it.
Thank you very much. And what an interesting conversation. I really appreciate
great.
It.
That's great.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Isaac Kahaney with hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flitner in Conversations on Healthcare. Maselli and Flitner have spent four decades addressing the challenges in accessing healthcare at community health centers, and they believe that healthcare is a right and not a privilege. Coming up, Dakota Datebook.
Tour the studios of some of Fargo-Moorhead's most popular artists during the FM Visual Artist Studio Crawl. This free event is October 5th and 6th, noon to 6 p.m. See painters, potters, sculptors, glass artists, and more, all demonstrating their work. Find the Studio Crawl map at prairiepublic.org/community.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 9th. On this date, in 1971, the University of North Dakota student newspaper, the Dakota Student, reported on remarks made by visiting speaker Lucy Komisar at the Memorial Union the previous day. Komisar, now a political radical feminist theater critic and author known for her praise of Julian Assange, was in 1971 serving as the vice president for public relations at the National Organization for Women. Earlier that year, she had published her book, The New Feminism. In it, Komisar criticized misogyny and systemic discrimination against women. Her chapter, The Message of Anthropology, drew on Margaret Mead's research to demonstrate that gender roles vary by society and argued that masculinity and femininity are social constructs. According to the Dakota Student, Komisar prefers to use the title Ms. because she does not feel marital status is important. She argued that girls are taught they're not competent and pointed out that the average woman earned only 60% of what men made for comparable work, citing discrimination and societal pressure to conform to traditional roles such as childcare. Komisar's primary focus during her talk at UND was on childcare and her belief that it should be the government's responsibility to provide it. She was quoted as saying, "The lack of child care centers is an effective way of preventing women from realizing their potential. All of these things work together to keep women in a position where they have no choices." She advocated for women to have the right to define their own lives and decide what they are going to do. She further argued that child care should be handled by centers rather than being the sole responsibility of mothers. In a subsequent speech later that year to the Boeing Management Club in Wichita, Kansas, she said, "Women have come to believe that no one can take care of your kids but you. This is especially prevalent in women who sacrifice careers or education to have a baby." Universities often invite controversial speakers to campus to expose students to points of views they might not have heard otherwise. Komisar's visit was an example of such an opportunity. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Andrew Alexis Varvel. I'm Ann Olquist.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And that's a wrap for this edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll return to the Fargo VA Hospital. They've just broken ground on a mental health facility. We want to learn what it's about and the new ways they're helping veterans with suicide prevention programs. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us.